Defense Secretary Robert Gates yesterday, during his visit to Afghanistan, expressed regret at civilian deaths in a recent U.S. airstrike, and then used it to justify sending more troops to Afghanistan. On August 22nd, a U.S. airstrike killed 90 Afghan civilians, mostly women and children, according to on-the-ground reports. The U.S. has vehemently denied that claim, saying instead that 30 to 35 Taliban militants were killed and only 4 to 5 civilians. After mobile phone video footage contradicted those claims, the U.S. now plans to open a joint investigation along with the Afghan government into the incident. One U.S. military official was quoted in an AFP report that approximately 4,000 airstrikes have been conducted in Afghanistan this year alone. That's more than an average of 15 strikes a day. Meanwhile, a suspected Afghan drug lord named Bashir Noorzai is being tried in New York on charges of attempting to smuggle tens of millions of dollars of heroin into the U.S. Noorzai and his lawyers claim that in fact he was an ally of the U.S. and helped defeat and disarm the Taliban. The case highlights the political compromises that the U.S. has repeatedly made in Afghanistan. Joining us this morning to take a look at the current state of U.S. policy and where it might be heading is Con Hallinan. He is a senior analyst with Foreign Policy in Focus and has written about Afghanistan extensively. Welcome to Uprising, Con.
Thanks for having me.
So first, let's talk about the civilian deaths. And in this particular incident on August 22nd, it doesn't seem that the United States is really, it really has much of a moral position to be in after making a particular claim and being defied with serious evidence. I understand this has happened before in Afghanistan, where the U.S. has killed civilians, denied it, sometimes even denied that it happened, only to be proven wrong.
Well, one of the things that the U.S. does is it sort of defines anybody that they kill are Taliban, and anyone who the Taliban kill are civilians. So it goes back to the same kind of terminology that they used during the Vietnam War. If you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, then you're an insurgent. And they said, well, when they went into the town, they found weapons. Well, everybody in Afghanistan is armed. And in this particular case, it was a group of local militia that were not associated with the Taliban. So the kind of claims that, you know, they're killing Taliban and all these kind of things, this is standard, and it goes back to really to the air war that originally the U.S. launched in the Korean War and then eventually Vietnam. And the numbers of civilian deaths have really accelerated, and it's related to the fact that the U.S. is losing in Afghanistan, and they don't have the troops, and NATO doesn't have the troops to do anything about it. And so what they're trying to do is to make up with that by using air power, and they can do an enormous amount of damage, but air power by definition is it's not selective. It kills whoever it gets close to.
So by nature of the changing tactic to use more airstrikes and air power in Afghanistan, the U.S. has essentially escalated its civilian deaths.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a one-to-one relationship between those two. The U.S. has, has this kind of, all wars have a story. World War I was the war to end all wars. World War II was the war to defeat fascism. This is the good war, and so Iraq is the bad war, and this is the good war. And so as a result, there's pretty much support both on the Republican, certainly on the Republican side, but also on the Democratic side. Mm.
Now, I was looking at the Wikipedia entry on Afghan civilian deaths. It has an interesting tally of all of the various sources, quite reliable sources, Associated Press, Human Rights Watch, United Nations, on the deaths caused by so-called insurgents since 2001 and those caused by U.S.-led military operations. The numbers are quite interesting. The deaths as a result of the quote-unquote insurgent actions are between 2,000 to 2,500, while the U.S.-led military actions are basically about 4,000 to almost 5,000 deaths. That's nearly twice as many being killed by U.S.-led military operations. I mean, if you go by this measure alone, what is it saying?
Well, I also think you have to be careful even with that figure four, that the Taliban killing civilians. there's a couple of different wars going on in Afghanistan, and it sort of depends upon where you are in what particular war. There's a war going on between a large number of the Afghans and the U.S. occupation forces and the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. But there was also a civil war going on between the Karzai government and the Taliban. And then there's various other wars going on between the drug dealers and the warlords and militias and all that kind of stuff. So it's a multiple sort of thing. It's just that every time the Taliban kills someone, that's a civilian. Every time the U.S. kills someone, well, it's a Taliban. So even that figure for the number of civilians that the Taliban have killed, I mean, I would take that with a grain of salt. I'd be careful about accepting that figure.
And it's likely then by that measure that the U.S. and NATO have probably killed far more civilians because it's, you know, the Taliban aren't wearing uniforms, and the U.S., as you've said, often in a knee-jerk way will name it, anybody they kill as a so-called militant or Taliban.
Well, the official designation of potential enemies, anyone from age 15 to 65. That's a pretty significant portion of the
So they're just using the
Afghan
age?
Population.
They're just using age as a measure?
Yeah. In other words, basically what they're doing is they say any male, you know, who is a young teenager to an old man is a potential insurgent. Of course, that is correct because what's happened is that this is rapidly morphing into a national liberation struggle. And no one has ever won a national liberation struggle in Afghanistan. It's really not a place that you want to get into a war.
My guest is Con Hallinan, and he's a senior analyst with Foreign Policy in Focus. We're talking about U.S. policy in Afghanistan. Con, do you think that U.S. policy is changing? I mean, aside from tactics, right, aside from changing it mostly from a ground war to a primarily air war, are the goals changing? If at all they were ever clear, do you think that the U.S. policy in the last few months of the Bush administration are either expanding or changing in a particular way?
I do think that there's as you say, that there's a military step up. I think what is not being done is that the position of the U.S. Is that it will not negotiate with the Taliban, and for one of the things it does is it talks about the Taliban and Al Qaeda as if it's the same organization, and they're not. They're not even close to the same organization. It's hard to even call Al Qaeda an organization per se. And this flies in the face of what the Afghans want. I mean, 74, the Globe and Mail, Canadian Globe and Mail, Toronto Globe and Mail, did a poll about 6 months ago. And what they found was that 74% of the Afghans wanted negotiations, and 54% of them even supported a coalition government with the Taliban. 52% want all foreign troops out within maximum of 5 years. So what's happening is the Bush administration, and I'm worried for whatever administration comes in with the next election, is pursuing basically a military solution. There is no military solution to what's going on in Afghanistan.
And so on, all we've been hearing coming from Bush and from Gates yesterday, from Obama and McCain, is more troops. I mean, that's essentially their answer to this
exactly.
problem.
And also a very disturbing development, which is that the U.S. is deploying death squads in both Afghanistan and Iraq. The recent book by Bob Woodward, The War Within, he alludes to this, that they've been using these extrajudicial hit squads in Iraq, and they have. But it's also going on in Afghanistan. Philip Alston, who's the United Nations Human Rights Council director in Afghanistan, has been investigating and protesting a number of these extrajudicial killings. There were two brothers that were murdered in Kandahar in January. And what he's hit is it's just a solid wall. I mean, nobody will take responsibility for it. Nobody says they're doing it, et cetera. So these death squads are operating in both countries. In Iraq, they killed the 17-year-old son of the governor of Salah ad-Din province, which is north of Baghdad, and a hit, and his nephew as well. This is the kind of thing which, of course, generates enormous opposition, not simply, you know, to the murder, but particularly in Afghanistan. You know, this sets off blood feuds.
Hmm. I mean, basically, you're talking about Afghan forces at the behest of
the
U.S.?
No, these are American forces.
American
special forces that are accompanied by local Afghans. But these are American special forces.
Hmm.
And the description of the hit in both Kandahar and Salah ad-Din province was these were American special forces. They came in the middle of the night, came in with night goggles. They came in with automatic weapons. You know, this was a real high-tech, sophisticated operation. This is absolutely legal. I mean, this is a violation of the Geneva Conventions. And politically, it's a disaster.
Khan, let's talk about drugs and the role they play inside Afghanistan, but also want to bring up this drug lord who's currently being tried in New York. First, Afghanistan, under the U.S. and NATO occupation, has once more become the world's largest heroin producer. What does this say about how the U.S. has been conducting its occupation vis-a-vis drugs?
Well, over 90% of the world's opium now comes from Afghanistan, and drugs make up 30% of the gross domestic product in Afghanistan. Now, this could only happen if the United States is working hand in glove. I mean, basically what happened was the United States came in, and they overthrew the Taliban, who suppressed the drug trade. When they overthrew the Taliban, they had to rely on the Northern Alliance and the warlords. And, of course, the Northern Alliance and the warlords were deep into opium production and heroin production. So we basically cut them a deal, and we would turn a blind eye, and they could deal, but then they would support us. This is exactly the same pattern as what happened in Laos with the heroin dealing in Laos and the U.S. secret war against North Vietnam and South Vietnam and Laos. It's exactly what happened in Central America with the cocaine trade. I mean, the U.S. has always been very closely associated with drug lords.
Hmm. So let's talk about this fellow in New York, Bashir Nourzai, who claims that he was working with the U.S. I mean, initially he was a Mujahideen fighter during the 1980s and the Soviet occupation, then supported the Taliban because he thought that the warlords were destroying Afghanistan, but then again changed allegiance to the United States after the U.S. began its invasion. Now he's being tried in a U.S. court, federal court, for drug smuggling, but he says, hey, I used to work with you guys.
Yeah, you know, he absolutely did used to work with us. And there's a whole range of people who are deeply involved in the drug trade that we've worked with. And I'm sure that this guy feels like he's been double-crossed. And, of course, he has been double-crossed because this is a show trial. You know, U.S. is doing nothing to suppress the drug trade. Of course, they can't do anything to suppress the drug trade. They would lose their base in Afghanistan. So they get a showcase trial like this. You know, they go after him. They're certainly not going after Ahmed Karzai, the president of Afghanistan's brother, who's also rumored to be one of the biggest drug lords in Afghanistan. This kind of corruption, this kind of fundamental corruption, it's just standard. Mm-hmm. And it's been going on for years and years and years. And, you know, people say shocking, shocking. It's sort of like that line from Casablanca. Oh, gambling going on. Shocking, shocking.
An interesting addition to that is Izzatullah Wasifi, the current head of the Afghan government's anti-corruption authority, apparently once spent more than 3 years in a Nevada prison for selling heroin in Las Vegas.
Shocking, shocking.
So, and this is a central government backed by the
right.
United States.
There is one little sideline here, which I do find interesting. The current American ambassador to Afghanistan is William Wood. I don't know if people, listeners, remember that name, but he used to be the U.S. ambassador to Colombia, and he was the guy who bought in the Dine Corporation, this private mercenary group, to conduct spraying of the cocaine, of cocoa fields in Colombia. Which, by the way, not only didn't work, but there's actually more cocoa being grown being grown now than there was when the spraying started in 2001. He's the new ambassador, and he's pushing the Karzai government to begin spraying the poppy fields. What's interesting is he's pushing the Karzai government to spray. The military, that is both the American and the NATO military, is saying under no circumstances can you spray. If you spray, the whole country is going to come to pieces.
Hmm.
I mean, the farmers are going to have nothing. So in a sense, what you have is you have the military saying, look, we have to protect the poppies. They're the only thing which keeps this entire operation from unraveling. At the same time as you have this guy, William Wood, who's pushing this Dyne Corporation, private mercenary organization, to do this spraying. I mean, it can't get any crazier.
And none of this gets covered in the mainstream media. I mean, the issue of drugs comes up, and all you hear is how the U.S. is very upset with the heroin production and how the heroin sales are fueling the Taliban insurgency, but you don't hear the other side of the story. I want to finally ask you, Khan, to comment a little bit about next year's elections in Afghanistan, and in particular, one interesting figure who may be running for the seat of president to replace Hamid Karzai. Listeners may recall Zalmay Khalilzad, the former U.S. Special Envoy to Afghanistan, then became U.S. Ambassador to Iraq, and now is the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. He's an Afghan-born American and one of the original signers to the Project for a New American Century. So he's a neocon through and through. He's running for president of Afghanistan next year.
And remember also, before that, he worked for Unocal Oil.
Right.
So I think he probably will be the next president. Karzai is referred to in Afghanistan as the president of Kabul, because that's as far as his authority reaches. And more and more of the country is sort of out of control. I think it's perfectly possible that the current UN ambassador will end up being president of Afghanistan. I think what it means is that I don't think it's going to have any effect on what the effect of the war is, but it does mean that there's going to be a stepped-up operations aimed at creating permanent American bases. And if you look at where the permanent American bases are in Afghanistan, they exactly parallel the pipelines that are planned to run through Afghanistan, gas and natural gas and oil pipelines. So. Mm. Partly, you know, this is the oil man making certain that Afghanistan is going to fit in to the overall pattern that they see as controlling the strategic resources in Central Asia.
I mean, this is essentially a high-level member of the Bush cabinet who could become president of one of the countries we're occupying. Very, very interesting twist to the story. It remains to be seen if it will play out. Khan Hallinan, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Khan Hallinan is a senior analyst with Foreign Policy in Focus. You can read his writings online at fpif.org. That stands for Foreign Policy in Focus.